Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, February 11, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we're going to be discussing ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. I'm very pleased to welcome to today's call two experts on our topic. They're going to speak in turn, each doing opening remarks of 6 or 8 to 10 minutes. Then we're going to have a little back and forth, some response time. And then, as always, we'll turn to the audience for questions, so please be ready with your questions. I mentioned we're going to hear first from Professor William Eskridge. He is the John A. Garver Professor of Jurisprudence at the Yale Law School. He'll be followed in his opening remarks by Professor David Bernstein at George Mason University, Foundation Professor of Law at the George Mason University School of Law. And with that, Bill Eskridge, please go right ahead. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dean, for your gracious introduction and for this opportunity to talk about the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which was passed by the Senate in November of 2013 by a very substantial bipartisan 64-32 margin. And I want to use this opportunity to talk a little bit about ENDA, its pluses and its minuses. And I want to start with the observation that almost all Americans are now protected against the most relevant kind of workplace discrimination by various federal statutes, most notably Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Age Discrimination Statute passed in 1967. So, for example, if you're a woman or a man, you are protected by federal law against discrimination because of your sex, and that does include harassment because of your sex, a advance that has been very helpful for working women as well as many working men, too. If you're a racial minority or an ethnic minority or indeed a Caucasian, Title VII protects you against employer discrimination because of your race or your ethnicity. If you're a member of a religious group that is subject to discrimination or even a large religious group that is discriminated against by some, Title VII also is a mandate to employers that you cannot be discriminated against because of your religion. And the 1967 statute prohibits, in many circumstances, discrimination based upon age. Lesbian and gay employees in the United States, it has been documented, are subject to a significant amount of discrimination, some of it open and blatant discrimination, and a significant amount of harassment as well. They are protected sometimes at the state level by state statutes, sometimes at the municipal level, but lesbian and gay people are not protected against sexual orientation discrimination as a matter of federal law. The same is true of transgender people, not protected against gender identity discrimination as a matter of federal law. In my opinion, it's actually very important that federal law openly protect these Americans in the same way that federal law protects other Americans against other kinds of discrimination. One reason that ENDA would be a very good idea to pass is that it would pass Congress with a bipartisan majority. As I said, 10 Republicans supported ENDA in the Senate. I'm sure a number of Republicans would support ENDA in the House. I think it's very important that a bipartisan legislative majority endorse the idea of non-discrimination for lesbian, gay, transgender citizens. These are productive workers, people's experience, employers' experience, empirical studies, etc., have documented that LGBT employees are worthy of protection. They contribute to the public good. They are good workers. And I would also add, on the whole, they're also very nice people. So one reason is simple justice, and it would be a useful idea for Congress to endorse that. The second idea is that LGBT people, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people, ought to have the same rights as other minorities. Today, as a matter of fact in the United States, the right not to be discriminated against in the workplace is a baseline right in the U.S. economy. It's a right that business works with very productively and that most Americans take for granted. LGBT people do not take it for granted, and they should. Now, I do think there is a concern, and it's a sensible concern worth pondering, that the INDA statute would burden some employers. And I think that's an objection that should be carefully deliberated. I think on the whole, this is not an objection that ought to be fatal to the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. For example, the Act does not apply to small businesses. Businesses with fewer than 15 employees are generally exempt from the Act's provisions. I think it would be useful for them not to discriminate, but they would not be legally subject to this particular statute. Moreover, the rules in the statute are, on the whole, fairly simple rules. There are a number of states, about half of them, and the District of Columbia, already prohibit employment discrimination based upon sexual orientation, and many of them also gender identity. The District of Columbia, where I still live and where I taught for a number of years, has had statutory protection since 1977. I did an empirical study of who made claims and what happened to them under the D.C. statute, which has been in effect now for 36 years. A number of race claims, a lot of sex discrimination claims, national origin, a very fair number of religion claims, very, very few claims raising sexual orientation discrimination, almost all of which were resolved by simple negotiation and mediation. I think businesses on the whole have not found INDA-type statutes at the state and municipal level to be burdensome statutes. And indeed, I think a criticism that might be made of INDA is that INDA is actually much more restrictive in its application and imposes many fewer burdens on employers even than Title VII does. So, for example, INDA on its face says that there shall be no liability based upon disparate impact. It says there should be no voluntary or involuntary affirmative action. And so for these reasons, it's actually not surprising that most business leaders actually support non-discrimination, and many of them specifically support INDA. Businesses all over the world, including businesses in the United States, have found in their own experience that LGBT persons are productive, that it is actually unproductive in the workplace for employees and supervisors to engage in discriminatory or otherwise disruptive behavior. And indeed, some businesses are very concerned about losing foreign business opportunities and officials to Canada and the United States because of discrimination that sometimes goes on in American workplaces. In short, with all of its limitations and flaws, INDA has a worthy idea at the very center of it, and it would be very useful for Republicans and Democrats alike, for Americans, in other words, to adopt this as the law of the land. Thank you.
David Bernstein?
Yeah, so in principle, I oppose legislation in general that requires private employers to adhere to non-discrimination norms. You know, in my perfect world, there wouldn't be such laws. There might very well be a change in the baseline so that an employer would have to affirmatively say, I don't want to adhere to these non-discrimination norms. But it would still be resolvable. It would be a baseline that could be overturned by contract, and employers and employees could resolve their terms of employment voluntarily, even if there was a baseline of non-discrimination, if they so chose. That says, I think Bill definitely makes a strong case that we're not talking about a world where there are no non-discrimination laws or there are very few non-discrimination laws, and the question is whether to add this new special one. We have a myriad of anti-discrimination laws of groups that are already protected from private discrimination, and the question presented is not whether to convert those laws into baselines or get rid of those laws entirely, but whether to extend them to LGBT people. And this presents a much harder question. So on the one hand, you have my libertarian objections to anti-discrimination laws that still apply, but on the other hand, I also believe in equal protection of the law, and there is a powerful case that if you're going to protect just about every other minority group, as Bill talked about, you should also protect sexual minorities. So it's a close call in my mind, but I think there are two reasons why I'm skeptical of ENDA. First of all, I see potential significant civil liberties problems arising from the legislation. Now, if the legislation was just you can't discriminate in terms of hiring and firing and was a fairly narrow law, and it is narrow in some ways, like Bill said, then I wouldn't worry about it. But the fact is, we have to assume that all the rules that have built up around sex discrimination and race discrimination, other forms of discrimination, are also going to be applied by courts to this legislation, even if it's not specified. So most importantly, I assume that hostile environment law is going to apply. And hostile environment law creates significant civil liberties problems. They don't create as many problems as they might with regard to sex and race discrimination, because there's a pretty wide and broad consensus in American society about sex and race discrimination and why they're bad and that they are bad and so forth and so on. But it's very different exactly what the status of homosexuality is morally and otherwise, and when it's okay to discriminate against gays, like in religious organizations or not, and whether gay marriage is a good thing or not, are still very much contested. So there's a lot more room for people to offend other people, and therefore a lot more potential for hostile environment claims. So take a few examples. An organization like the Boy Scouts of America, not covered by any exception that I could see to ENDA, but let's say the BSA continues to promote the idea that homosexuality is not morally straight, and therefore gays can't serve as scoutmasters. Well, at least for now, they're protected in not hiring scoutmasters by Dale v. Boy Scouts of America. But let's say there's a secretary that they've hired, or administrative staff, or janitors, or anybody else, and they say, you know, I have to go to work every day and hear about how my organization opposes allowing gays to be scoutmasters because they think it's not morally straight. That really offends me. I can't do my work properly. It's a hostile environment. It's not at all clear to me that they lose on summary judgment on that claim. And you could get around the First Amendment that way and force the Boy Scouts to change their policies. What if some managers of a business or even just their fellow employees invite spouses to various social functions outside of work but don't invite someone's same-sex spouse? Could that contribute to a hostile environment? It seems to me it could. But should the law be dictating that an individual in their free time has to treat gay couples the same way they treat straight couples? What if employees during break time read Robert George arguing that homosexual acts are contrary to natural law, or have the office radio tuned to Rush Limbaugh and he plays some sort of satirical song mocking a gay rights group? Could that be a hostile environment? There are cases like that involving sex discrimination and race discrimination, so again, it'll come up probably much more often in this context. Then there's the question of what you're allowed to bring in as evidence to support a discrimination claim. There have been plenty of cases, or at least some cases, in the sex and race discrimination context where employees have been allowed to bring in evidence of what their employers do in their free time. They gave John Silber of Boston University gave a speech where he said that he thinks that women would be better off, it would be better for them and for society if they were less often in the workplace, more often home with their wife and children. The First Circuit said that's perfectly acceptable evidence in a sex discrimination claim that Boston University discriminated against a woman professor. So does that mean that if you are an employer who belongs to a church that doesn't approve of gay marriage or of homosexuality, that could be brought in as evidence? That you donated to an anti-gay marriage campaign? I think it could be brought in as evidence, but it seems to me that that would have a chilling effect on freedom of religion. So, you know, you might say, well, but people aren't going to be so touchy and bring such claims. I'm glad to hear that there haven't been a lot of outrageous claims in D.C., but I'm not so sure. The Elaine photography case, a cert petition for which is currently pending in the Supreme Court, is an example of why I'm a little worried about this. Elaine photography, a photographer said, you know, I was asked to photograph a lesbian wedding, I believe it was, and she said, no, I don't do gay weddings. It's against my religious beliefs. And she was sued under the local anti-discrimination law and went all the way to the Mexico Supreme Court. She lost. But the key to me is, look, someone doesn't want to photograph your wedding. They think your wedding is morally repugnant. They're polite to you about it. Why would you sue them other than you just want to punish them for their bad beliefs? No one really wants a photographer who doesn't think their wedding is a time for celebration to photograph it, but it's just a way of sort of burning the heretics, and I'm afraid that you might get some of that in this context. So I have these concerns about civil liberties issues. That, you know, again, might not be enough to stop me from supporting, and again, it's still a close call, but I have another problem, which is that I think that ENDA is likely to be counterproductive in all but a symbolic sense. Symbolically, I understand perfectly well why a bill says it's justice, everyone else is protected, we want the same rights as everybody else. On the other hand, empirical studies that I've seen suggest that nowadays the vast, vast majority of anti-discrimination claims are brought not for hiring, but for firing. In other words, almost no one ever sues because they weren't hired. It's very hard to prove why you weren't hired. And even if you do prove it, it's very hard to show damages because usually by the time you bring your case, you found another job. So people usually sue when they're disgruntled because they're fired. For good or bad reasons, they're disgruntled. If you look at age discrimination and discrimination based on disability, the vast majority of these claims are for firing. And the vast majority are tossed out by the courts because mostly they're people who were fired, are angry, they heard a stray remark that may have led them to think maybe there's discrimination, and they sue, but the suit doesn't really accomplish much because they get tossed down in summary judgment. And overall, of course, some people are really discriminated against and some people win. But the question is, what are the overall economic effects? And my suspicion is that the overall economic effects is that what these laws do is they put a tax on an employer who wants to hire an employee of the protected group. Since the Age Discrimination Act of Employment was passed, and since the Disability Discrimination Act was passed, there have been actually fewer and fewer people in these categories who are able to get jobs, and there are, of course, a lot of different things going on, but I think part of it is you have a choice of hiring someone who's 50, hiring someone who's 30. Hire someone who's 30, they can't sue you if you fire them. Hire them if you're 50, they can. This is just pure rational economics. It's not nice, but that's, employers are out there to make a living. If they have a choice between two evenly qualified employees, one of whom has an extra burden with them, which is that they could sue if they get fired, you're less likely to hire them. And it seems to me that if you take just an example, let's say you're a construction manager and you're a really pro-gay rights guy, you want to hire the first openly gay construction worker in this very macho environment where people sometimes make these nasty remarks. Are you going to do it more likely or less likely if the person can sue if it doesn't work out? Seems to me that if you're doing it from a pure business decision perspective, you say, look, I have 20 people lined up for this job. If I hire the guy who's openly gay and I can't control my employees and they harass him despite my best efforts, he's going to sue me, but I could give him the chance if I didn't have this law. So on a symbolic basis, I understand the impetus, I understand the equality, that everyone else is protected, we are too, but I do have significant concerns about, A, whether there'll be major civil libertarian concerns that will arise from the law, and second, whether, despite the symbolic victory this would be for gay rights advocates, whether it would actually discourage rather than encourage people to hire openly gay employees.
Thank you, Professor David Bernstein. We've got a lot of people on the phone. I want to get to your questions, but before we do that, let's give Professor Bill Eskridge, a chance to respond.
Thank you, Dean. I thought that David's comments were extremely thoughtful, and I appreciate them. Here's on the counterproductive point. About half the states prohibit job discrimination based on sexual orientation, and D.C. has since 1977. And there's no evidence that it's been counterproductive in those ways at the state level. I do want to, however, add to David's point, there is a very important way in which ENDA could be counterproductive from some points of view. And that is that transgender employees are now winning in the South and elsewhere in federal court on the claim that discriminating against them is discrimination because of sex. And that's under Title VII. If that's the rule, and it's not the final rule until the Supreme Court agrees, then passing ENDA would actually hurt transgender plaintiffs, possibly, because ENDA places a lot more restrictions and gives employers a lot more defenses for transgender claims than Title VII does. So from a transgender perspective, actually they're doing better under Title VII at this point than they would do under ENDA. On the libertarian point, I think it's important to note that liberty lies on both sides of the equation. For a lesbian and gay employee in many firms, literally their liberty is threatened by the workplace. And I'm not talking about slurs. I'm not talking about mere words. The harassment cases that you get for lesbian and gay plaintiffs, and these are usually denied under Title VII, sometimes not, are cases where lesbian and gay employees are actually brutally assaulted. They are poked at. They are mock raped. These are not words cases. These are cases where their literal liberty, their physical integrity, if you will, are assaulted by their coworkers, and on some occasions, employers do not provide any protections. So there is a libertarian feature to including LGBT employees in this protected category. I would say on the just words part, the U.S. Supreme Court has not shown itself bashful in striking down the application of non-discrimination laws when they involve just words. David mentioned Elaine Photography. You've got to remember that was not a job discrimination case. That was a public accommodations discrimination case. And the leading cases in that are the Supreme Court's decision in Hurley, the Boston Parade case, and Dale, the Boy Scouts case, where the Supreme Court said state applications of non-discrimination public accommodation laws are unconstitutional when they target words and expression. The Supreme Court has never endorsed the idea in one of its sexual harassment cases that hostile environment is created by mere language. Now, that area remains to be developed by the Supreme Court, and we sort of await their decisions. So I wouldn't want to jump to a whole lot of hasty conclusions, particularly in light of the Supreme Court's very cautious doctrine in this area.
David Bernstein, a minute or two before we go to the audience.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I haven't personally studied empirically the gay rights statutes of the states and whatnot, and it's good to hear that they're being applied in a sensible way. I am a little concerned that, you know, sometimes when these things become federalized and you get a more aggressive and experienced bar that's used to filing race and sex discrimination claims, that they will try to expand the scope of these things. I agree the Supreme Court precedent is generally pretty good on protecting speech and whatnot, and things have to be severe and pervasive. There are lower courts that have been less accommodating to the Supreme Court than they're supposed to be. But, of course, you always have this concern that when a law is passed, they say, well, don't worry about expansive liability because the Supreme Court will step in. The Supreme Court, of course, is quite divided. In Hurley, it was 9-0, but some of these other cases regarding how severe or pervasive a hostile environment has to be, you do have closer votes, and we don't know who's going to be on the Supreme Court in the future. Just to give an example from a different jurisdiction, in New Jersey, one offensive joke has been held to be sufficient to get hostile environment liability. So there's obviously a vast range of opinion in state Supreme Courts among legal scholars. And of course, and I'm not saying that this is Bill particularly, but the people who are most aggressively in favor of NDAR also tend to be the same people who are most aggressively in favor of doing away with whatever limits we do have on anti-discrimination laws in general in terms of free speech and whatnot. They opposed Dale. Dale was 5-4. So I'm not going to take a radical position on this and say it's inevitably going to be a huge disaster. But again, there are some reasons for concern.
Let's check in with the audience. In a moment, we're all going to hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, or perhaps both of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller.
This is a question for Professor Eskridge. Assuming ENDA were the law right now, we've all heard about Michael Sam coming out in college, and he's widely expected to go somewhere in the first or second day of the NFL draft. If ENDA were the law right now, would Michael Sam have a viable claim for every team who passed him over?
The short answer to that is no. He wouldn't have a viable claim for any of the teams that pass him over. And the reason for that is that employers, in this case, I guess, football teams. It's widely known, and I'm sure there are experts who would testify to this because it's true. When they make a decision about whether to draft a player, there is a very complicated basket of considerations that they take into account, including the position that the player plays, the scouting reports that particular team has acquired on the player, and so on and so forth. So the short answer is no, though he might have a claim for race discrimination, for discrimination based upon religion. One important thing to keep in mind is that virtually every American has a certain feature and probably a whole basket of features that might be the basis for discrimination. And so I wouldn't be worried if I were an NHL team or National Football League team.
David Bernstein, you want to weigh in here?
Let's go on to the next question, I think. That seems right to me.
Okay, once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one caller with a question at this point.
This is Matt McReynolds in California. My question is primarily for Professor Eskridge on the aspect of gender identity within ENDA. Out here in the West Coast, as I'm sure you're familiar, we've had a lot of debates about transgender laws, especially in the school context. And within those debates, there seems to be disagreement and difference of opinion among supporters of those bills as to what exactly can be used to measure or limit gender identity. For instance, some would advocate for gender fluidity, that gender can change from day to day, and many others have said that gender identity would have to be continuous and exclusive for a period of time. So my question about ENDA is whether you believe there are any such limitations expressly or implied in ENDA, and also what you think should be, employers should look to as they find themselves with those kinds of questions.
Well, Matt, I think that's actually a very good question. I think we should make you a federal judge because that goes really to the core of the statute. It's unanswered in the statute, I would say. Matt, the statute does define gender identity. It prohibits gender identity-based discrimination in Section 4. But in Section, I believe, 3A7, the statute defines gender identity in the following terms. Gender identity means, and I'm quoting, the gender-related identity, appearance, or mannerisms, or other gender-related characteristics of an individual, with or without regard to the individual's designated sex at birth. Now, I'm not sure the statute answers your question whether or not an employee can change her gender identity on a daily basis. It would seem to me that would make a more difficult claim of discrimination because the courts in, for example, ADA cases, that's the American with Disabilities Act, the courts in ADA cases have not been eager to impose a lot of administrative requirements on employers, even though that seems to have been the point of the Americans with Disabilities Act. And the statute that ENDA is, explicitly in Section 8 of the statute, says that employers can still impose grooming requirements and dress requirements, and it's not going to be required to build new facilities, which presumably is talking about bathroom facilities, among others. So I would say Section 8 of the statute, which is the part that has these special accommodations for employers with regard to trans employees, I think that would support a notion that one has to have a stable presentation for the employer to respond to. My personal preference, and I'm not saying this is actually what ENDA would enact into law, but my personal preference in terms of policy is I think the United States should do what the United Kingdom did several years ago with a lot of support on both sides of the aisle in the United Kingdom. And that is that the United Kingdom has a national registry now where someone makes a declaration, here is the sex that I want to be considered. Some of the people are transgender, some are not. And if one wants to change one's sex identification, then you would have to go through the administrative process that's set up in the United Kingdom. Now, we don't have that in this country, partly because of federalism, and I respect that. But that, in my opinion, would be probably the most sensible regime for us to have. We already do it to some extent as regards race now. Again, not a national registry, but it's basically pro-choice. You declare your race. Elizabeth Warren at one point declared her race as Native American. Many of my friends who are from Spain or their parents were from Spain do not declare themselves Latino or Hispanic for various reasons of ethnicity and whatnot. And I respect that. Rosemary Barquette, recently retired federal judge, for a number of years identified herself as Latina, even though she was of, I believe, Arab-American descent, but because she grew up and identified in Mexico. Well, I'm kind of okay with that as long as people are fairly transparent.
So this is David Bernstein. Let me weigh in a little bit. I mean, I'm not an expert in the drafting history of ENDA, but if you look over the statute as I was doing this morning, it at least appears to the outside observer as if the transgender part was kind of thrown in as an addition without all that much thought being given to some of these issues. So, for example, it says that no building of new facilities is required, assumingly meaning that you don't have to build a special gender-neutral bathroom if you don't have one. But that doesn't really answer even that question, because, well, what if you already have 10 bathrooms in the building? Does that mean the fact that you don't have to build any new ones doesn't speak to whether you have to designate one that already exists, for example? Right, and then there are all sorts of issues that come up with this. I mean, the bathrooms, I don't want to get into the bathroom thing too much, but obviously there are issues that have come up in schools and workplaces about people who present, who look as one gender but identify as the other using the other bathrooms, and that could create a problem for women who are sensitive to, and others who are sensitive to having someone of a different sex use, or what they perceive as a different sex, using their bathroom, particularly sexual assault survivors. So all sorts of stuff like that assumedly will be decided by some combination of rulemaking and the courts. And, of course, that's not a very good way of doing it. It's nice to know what the law is going to mean and say before you actually enact it. And this is sufficiently vague about both that issue, the issue of what does it mean to have a gender identity, that who really knows what's going to happen. Relatedly, I think it's a very interesting issue of why transgender should be lumped in with sexual orientation to begin with. I'm interested in this in part because I've had two different people just randomly in the last few weeks, when the issue of gay rights come up, and say, hey, what's up with the T in the LGBT? Isn't people who think that they are really a different gender completely a different story than people who have a different sexual orientation? Right? I mean, there are people who, who have the biology of a man who say they're a woman, but they still like women. So, what does that mean? How is that like? That doesn't affect their sexual orientations. Obviously, is still heterosexual in that sense, or whatever. I mean, it's very complicated, but I think it's an interesting question. I mean, I haven't really seen discussed anywhere is why the gay rights movement has put transgender on the agenda as being in the same category. It's not that they shouldn't necessarily sympathize and want to help, but why it's part of the same category when it seems to be something different. And finally, and as part of that also, I think there's a lot of controversy and lack of certainty scientifically, is why are there people who present, who have all the physical equipment of a man or a woman, who really believe in a way that will make that they so deeply believe it that some of them get suicidal if they can't change it, they are really of the other gender? Is it real? Is it something in their genetics? Is it something in hormones they received at birth or thereafter? Is it a psychological issue? Is it different depending on who it is? And therefore, I think it's very problematic, given the way our anti-discrimination law works, to have a very broad, sweeping rule about not to be able to discriminate against gender identity. Because again, I don't want people harassed or otherwise getting into trouble because they're transgender. However, I do think it's a problem that the way the statute is written, it seems to me that it doesn't matter how you look. It only matters what gender you identify with. Because you have someone who comes in to work every day, looks like a woman, dresses like a woman, but says, I'm a man, I expect to be treated like a man. Okay, the bathroom issue will come up there. But even beyond that, can the government really dictate to a private person, to all the, you know, because of hostile environment law, to all the employees essentially of a company, that even though someone looks like a woman, dresses like a woman, has a physical being of a woman, that they have to address that person as a man and call them Mr. And use the he pronoun? I mean, that person would certainly like that. That's what they feel. But is that really the government's place to make what it seems to me is an ideological decision that this person who presents in one way really is something else because, you know, they say so and we're not really sure why. I am a little skeptical that the government should have that authority, and I think it might even raise some difficult First Amendment issues.
Well, Dean, let me respond to David, because Matt has raised some great questions, and David has raised some also great questions that are somewhat different. So why is the transgender category linked in with the LGBT categories? And I think there's a simple answer to that. Though I want to add to David's complexity as well. The simple answer to it is that what they have in common is gender. I've done a casebook, which is widely used in American law schools, called Sexuality, Gender, and the Law. And it started out as a casebook mainly about LGB issues, lesbian and gay issues. But we always had something about transgender as well, because the discrimination and indeed the prejudice against, say, lesbians and gay men is not just prejudice about sexuality, it's prejudice about gender. That traditionally, for example, in the military and in other workplaces, lesbian women were discriminated against not just because they engaged in sexual intercourse that straight people considered icky, and indeed many straight men consider lesbian intercourse quite erotic, but they were discriminated against also, and maybe more importantly, because they were violating traditional gender norms by their not being romantically interested in men, not wanting to marry a man, not wanting to procreate with a man as part of a romantic experience. And so lesbian and gay issues have, in my opinion, always been issues about gender, as well as sexuality. Now, transgender people are more transparently issues of gender. And in many ways, ENDA would not be necessary if the federal courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court, had interpreted Title VII more broadly. But as I've said before, the Supreme Court has not interpreted Title VII broadly, and Congress can kind of bank on that. The Supreme Court has interpreted it very cautiously, not just under First Amendment auspices, but just the terms of the statute. And we've seen that repeatedly in recent years. So that's, I think, the big irony of ENDA, is that Title VII is actually very liberal at this point at the circuit court level, no division that I can tell for transgender rights and for utterly equal treatment, raising a lot of these issues that David has raised. So the issues are already there in Title VII. The world hasn't ended yet in Title VII, notwithstanding these recent cases, because employers and workers generally tend to work these things out more informally. So if David, as I think appropriate for him to do, raises these issues of, well, what if, let me tell you, these issues are here now, whatever you do with ENDA, and there are none of these accommodations like Section 8. So Section 8 does have the ambiguities that David has specified, but there are no ambiguities in Title VII. Title VII does not allow employers to not have to add new facilities. Title VII does not allow employers, at least on its face, to have grooming and dress requirements. Now, it can be interpreted that way. Supreme Court hasn't reached that issue yet. But ENDA is actually a more conservative statute, a more libertarian statute with regard to transgender employees than Title VII is, at least as it is now being interpreted by conservative courts. These are courts in the South, as well as the more liberal Ninth Circuit, as well as the EEOC. So that's an irony there. Now, David does put on the table, and I don't believe Dean, you have the right people to answer this. David doesn't have an answer, and neither do I. What causes someone to be transgender, or what causes someone to be gay? And David doesn't have the answer to that, and I am totally with David. I think the scientists have not made any progress on that. The only point I would make, based on my own experience, I am myself gay, but not trans, but I've known a number of trans students and colleagues and so forth. And I'm also a devout Presbyterian. So I myself am actually quite religious, and I have many religious friends, many of them Catholics, Jews, Muslims, Protestants, etc. And what causes someone to be trans or gay is deeply rooted in causes we don't understand. But it's not something you choose or can change, like going to Walmart and selecting a pair of jeans. It's something that becomes a part of you, in many ways like religion. I don't know why I'm Presbyterian. I have many friends who are Catholic, who were not raised Catholic, but who feel so much at home in the Catholic Church, who find the Catholic theology deeply comforting, the Catholic services reassuring and wonderful and connective to God. Why they feel that way, they don't know, and I don't know either. These are features of people's personalities that are beyond our conscious choice, at least as I see it.
Yeah, thanks. That's really very thoughtful stuff. I guess, you know, one thing that might come up here is that, given that I've had these experiences where people who are very sympathetic to gay rights are a little bit more skeptical, or maybe a lot more skeptical, at the same exact kinds of considerations apply to transgender, there are the possibility that if you pass all this at once and some of these sort of unusual transgender type issues arise, it might undermine support for the broader legislation. But I do have a question. If I'm going too far afield, feel free to take a question or stop me. But my understanding of feminist theory and queer theory, which is not all that broad, is that the idea is that homosexuality, the problem, underlying problem of society with it, is that is what they call gender essentialism. That if you're a man, you have to act a certain way, and if you're a woman, you have to act a certain way sexually and otherwise. And gays and lesbians defy those that gender essentialism, and but they're wrong. There's actually a fluidity in gender and all that, which I think is pretty well accepted, outside of religious context at least these days. With trans, I mean, that seems to be the exact opposite. And if someone says, "I'm a woman, but I look like a man, but I'm really a woman," that actually seems to say there is something essential about gender. That I can't really be that if I have these feminine thoughts or urges, whatever they are.
David, it's Dean Royer. You're breaking up now. I don't know if you've changed the position with your phone.
Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe I just moved my. Is that better? Or is it the phone?
Sounds better now.
Okay, good. Sorry about that. Yeah, so as I was saying, it seems to me that the idea that being trans is actually that there's some contradiction between the advocates of transgender rights, the advocates of gay rights, and that the trans folks say, well, we really are, of course, the opposite sex, even though we present one way, but that seems to be gender essentialist, when with gay rights, the whole notion has been that we should be against gender essentialism.
Well, let me tell you, not as an authoritative expositor of what you're calling queer theory, which is a commonly used term, I might add, is that for better or for worse, David, there's great heterogeneity. And I'm not talking about among the theorists. I'm talking about among human beings. A number of trans people who are my age, I'm very old, are people who see it exactly the way you're describing. They think that they are woman born in a man's body, and the whole point of being transgender is to fix this asymmetry. But a lot of younger transgender people don't see it that way at all. They do see gender as something that is less fixed, and a number of younger transgender people take the position that they have no gender. A number of people, of course, are born with gender and sexual features of each sex. I mean, this is a very significant but tiny minority
right.
of the human population, but it's naturally occurring. And those folks are people in yet another category. So human variation is quite broad. And I think the central message of my scholarship and of ENDA is that there is a benign range of gender variation in the human race, and also a benign range of sexual variation in the human race. That a majority of people, and indeed for gender maybe a large majority, fall into easily recognizable cultural categories. And that's fine, and that's great. But a minority, and an increasingly vocal minority, don't fall into those large categories. But the fact that they don't fall into the categories is not any indication that they are bad people, or would do bad things, or are bad workers, or are dysfunctional, or less intelligent, or mentally depraved, or anything like that. And the scientists overwhelmingly support that proposition. And I might also add that lived experience supports that proposition, that people in the workplace who have trans sisters, brothers, coworkers, bosses, etc., a lot of them have initial shock. A lot of them feel, well, you were lying to me by not telling me this about yourself, and so on and so forth, you know, because they were frightened. But then, when you actually work on a day-to-day basis, the trans employee, the trans sibling, the trans school teacher actually does a great job. And I can tell you as like a gay person who was denied tenure at the University of Virginia, which, David, as you know, this is usually a career-ending move when a law school denies you tenure. You know, my view is that people who are sexual and gender minorities often have to work twice as hard to get the same kind of recognition as people who fit better into cultural templates. So I think it's a good bet for corporate America, for business America, and for workplace America to sort of swallow people's surprise, some cases prejudices, often stereotypes more than prejudices, and sort of say, look, this is all normal. These are normal people. They should be treated like other employees. We're not going to give them special treatment. The statute says no affirmative action. I think that's fine. I think it's great. We're not going to collect numbers. The statute actually prohibits the EOC from collecting data and numbers about lesbian and gay and trans employees. I think that's great. I think it would be very hard to like figure out the numbers because so many people are either discreet or closeted. The statute just says you've got to be treated. The actual language of the statute, the core obligation for employers anyway, it also applies to unions and so forth, is that it's an unlawful employment practice. This is Section 4A. For an employer to discriminate against any individual with respect to the compensation terms, conditions, or privileges of employment. And though there are complexities at the margin, and I think the First Amendment is a very powerful bulwark for me as well as the Supreme Court against overgeneralizing hostility from remarks, even inappropriate remarks. That is, it's a simple requirement. It's a requirement that is supported not only by decency and empirical studies, but also to some extent by the libertarian presumption that David and I share.
So let me
make another call for questions here, David.
Sure,
if you don't mind. We don't have any callers with questions pending. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We'd be happy to take your questions. We have a few minutes left. With that, David, I think you were going to interject there.
Yeah, sure. You know, let me just say that I agree with Bill that all people should be treated with dignity and respect, and we're only really disagreeing about whether this particular law in the various ways it might be interpreted might do more harm than good or otherwise. But specifically with the transgender issue, one thought I had when hearing Bill discussing the fact that a lot of corporate employers currently have anti-discrimination policies, is that on the one hand, maybe that would let courts look to the norms they're developing, but on the other hand, since it's a pretty new issue, since, I mean, there have obviously been transgender people for a while, but you know, since it's much more open and accepted and much many more companies are dealing with it openly now, it could very well be that that the law is premature only in this sense, putting aside the other possible objectives that I raised, that it might be worthwhile to allow these companies to develop their policies, the big Fortune 500 companies and others develop policies without the weight of the law on them to see what naturally develops. I mean, you know, it's hard to say, are you discriminating against transgender people if there's no gender-neutral bathroom? Well, if all the big Fortune 500 companies that have policies that prohibit discrimination wind up having those bathrooms, I think would be some evidence that that's how the spontaneous order decrees it once you have non-discrimination. If it turns out there are other ways of solving issues like that without requiring that, that might mean that you don't need those things and so forth. A lot of these ambiguities, exactly who constitutes a transgender person, how fluid is identity and so forth, some of the questions that the caller raised, these are things that the companies that have these policies are going to have to deal with. So it might make sense before, you know, rushing headlong into legislation to let the private solutions develop themselves so we see what a non-discrimination norm looks like as people negotiate these things privately rather than come up with a top-down solution through the bureaucracy and the court system.
David, I like your invocation of von Hayek. You know, the idea of spontaneous private dealing. The problem is that the horse has already left the barn. And let me give you one example. In Glenn versus Brumby, this was the 11th Circuit in Atlanta in 2011. This was a panel that included Bill Pryor, who I think was at the Federalist Society Convention last October, a very distinguished judge, and other very conservative, distinguished federal judges on the 11th Circuit. In Glenn versus Brumby, the 11th Circuit unanimously held that discriminating on the basis of transgender was a blatant, open and shut violation of Title VII. And here's what the panel said. The panel said that the federal courts, this was in 2011, are ruling, and I'm quoting Judge Pryor and his colleagues, with near total uniformity on behalf of transgender claimants. The Sixth Circuit in the Midwest had ruled that. District of Columbia District Court in Schroer versus Billington had ruled that. There have been some decisions since then ruling that, the EOC since then, et cetera, et cetera. So the problem is that we already, you know, have that liability. Now, I'm kind of with David. Now let's see what develops, because the norm is already out there. It's already being entrenched in Title VII. And, you know, so far we've not seen the kind of cases that David is worried about. Now, on the other hand, this is still a fairly recent development. The Sixth Circuit case was back in 2004, which is, what, 10 years ago. The D.C. Court of Appeal, the D.C. District Court case, Schroer and Billington, Library of Congress case, was 2008. And Glenn versus Brumby, which is the Judge Pryor case, was 2011. And as I say, there have been some cases since then, and the EOC has issued a guidance since then. But I don't believe there's been any great crisis in corporate America because of these various issues now that Title VII does clearly in most of the circuits offer a cause of action for discrimination based upon transgender identity, etc. And I do repeat that Title VII does not have any of these employer accommodations, any of these employer defenses that INDA has, at least the ones that David and I have been talking about, like Section 8, which is the facilities one, and the grooming one, which is Section 8A. So on those dimensions, Title VII is more intrusive than INDA would be, and yet I have not seen corporate America or the Chamber of Commerce reacting strongly to what's been going on for the last 10 years in conservative federal jurisdictions, as well as more liberal ones like the D.C. District Court.
Well, I think that's a very fair point. Yeah. Sorry, guys.
That's okay, David. I was going to say we've got a couple more questions. Penny, you want to go to the next caller? We've got a couple minutes left. Let's take another question.
Hi. Yes, thank you for speaking today. I have a quick question. I'm curious as to the application to state and federal law and the interplay both with, I guess, with ENDA and then really just in general. I know, for instance, last Thursday, a Supreme Court of the state of Washington case came out regarding the Washington law against discrimination, which has a much broader exemption for religious nonprofits. And I'm curious with regard to the federal law that basically says, yeah, states can, you know, provide broader protections. How are they going to interpret that? Who are we protecting, either the religious nonprofits or the, you know, or the individuals with regard to ENDA or other employment discrimination? I'm curious how you think that's going to play out.
Well, I think it's a highly relevant question. This is Bill Eskridge. Section 6 of ENDA does address at least the specific question of religious nonprofits. Section 6A of ENDA says that exempted from the coverage of ENDA, and it tracks Title VII, are two categories of possible defendants. One is schools that are managed, controlled, or supported by religious denominations or whatnot. And then more broadly, what they call but do not define, religious corporations, associations, societies, and educational institutions. So religious nonprofits, like Catholic Charities, if they're exempt from Title VII, they are exempt from ENDA. Now, in Title VII, they'd be exempt for religion-based discrimination. ENDA would add to that they are exempt for sexual orientation or gender identity discrimination. Now, the way that ENDA relates to state laws, it's in Section 15 of ENDA, and here's what it says. It says this act, ENDA, shall not invalidate or limit the rights, remedies, or procedures available to an individual claiming discrimination prohibited under any other federal law or regulation or any law or regulation of a state or political subdivision of a state. So that means if the state law went further than ENDA, ENDA would not preempt the state law probably. On the other hand, if the state does not go as far as ENDA, in other words, the state would say, well, we're going to give this particular corporation an exemption or a defense, well, that means you're not going to have a cause of action under state law, but you still might have a cause of action under ENDA, depending on how you interpret the various defenses that ENDA offers on its face.
The only thing I'd add is that, as far as I could tell, at least pending the outcome of the religious freedom cases under Obamacare.
I mean, the Hobby Lobby cases?
Hobby Lobby.
David, you're breaking up. David, you're breaking up again, if you could reposition.
Sorry. I was saying that depending on the outcome of the Hobby Lobby case, RFRA would also be a background restriction on the law, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Well, it looks like we're out of questions. We've got 2 minutes left. I want to give each of you just 30 seconds, if you could, just to express any final thoughts or wrap up, starting with Bill Eskridge.
Thank you, Dean. Well, I think what I would say is that I would emphasize the common ground. I think it's very remarkable, as we saw in the Senate, where you had senators like Orrin Hatch, who's a very respected senator on the Republican side, Rob Portman, Senator Toomey of Pennsylvania, Senator Heller of Nevada, Senator McCain of Arizona, Senator Flake of Arizona, Senator Kirk of Illinois, and several other Republicans emphatically supporting in the Senate the idea of non-discrimination based on sexual orientation as well as gender identity. Believe me, we never would have seen something like this, where almost all the Democrats voted yes, and these very distinguished Republicans of all sorts of backgrounds. And so I would say the debate has already moved us pretty far. I do think that the Federal Society and members should join people like me in urging the House of Representatives to take up this issue. It's an overwhelmingly interesting and important issue, at least to debate. And the House of Representatives should very seriously consider the points that David is raising If it wants to be in the game, and if it wants to head off where Title VII has already gone, if you're concerned about this, you need to get the House of Representatives deliberating about ENDA to see what kind of rules it wants employers to have to follow in these transgender cases.
David Bernstein, a final thought.
Yeah, I think Bill makes a good point. Whatever the ideal world I'd like to live in is, in a world where anti-discrimination law is the norm, I think gay rights laws are coming. It's hard to come up with a good explanation of why all the other minority groups should be protected, but sexual and gender minorities and whatnot should not. But there is this problem we have, which I wrote a whole book about a decade ago, that there are people out there who really put anti-discrimination norms above everything, above First Amendment rights, above freedom of religion and whatnot, and they often do it through the courts and the agencies, not through the statute. So it would he's probably right that we'd be better off overall if Republicans who have some skepticism, particularly about the civil liberties aspect here, were in the game and were willing to, and could make a good compromise protecting religious freedom and limiting the ways these rights might impinge on freedom of speech before the courts and the bureaucracy get to it in the future.
Well, I want to thank both Professor David Bernstein and Professor William Eskridge for your thoughts today. We certainly appreciate you joining our call. To the audience, also thank you for joining our call and for your participation. Please check the Federal Society's website and the Teleforum conference call webpage for future calls. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.